It is Monday, July 25th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Democratic Party opens its national convention in Philadelphia, hoping to give its prospective presidential nominee Hillary Clinton a boost in her bid for this year's election. But party divisions were on display, and we're going to speak with our correspondent on the scene to find out what happened. We'll also ask an international security expert what an apparent failed suicide bombing in Germany says about the influence of the Islamic State in Europe. And I'll speak to a sports attorney concerned about how international sports bodies have handled a Russian doping scandal ahead of next month's Olympics. It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, it's day one of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. The party is trying to put on a show of unity in the face of a controversy about leaked emails that show Democratic leaders tried to ease Hillary Clinton's path to the nomination by mocking her challenger, Bernie Sanders. Despite that controversy, award-winning journalist and presidential historian Jonathan Alter told VOA that he does not expect this convention to be as dramatic as the Republican Party's event last week.
The Democratic convention in Philadelphia is going to be a much more predictable coronation of Hillary Clinton, and it will be an indication of whether the Democrats can follow script, unify, bring in the Sanders people and move off in a disciplined way to the presidency. And it will be a chance for the party to put its best foot forward and to introduce both the presidential nominee and the vice presidential nominee, both of whom give important acceptance speeches.
Well, for more on the convention, we're joined on the line by our correspondent Doug Bernard in Philadelphia. Hi, Doug.
Hello, Michael.
Well, what can you tell us about how the convention has started today?
Well, so here we are, situated in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, as it is known. But today, some might think that it actually was the city of boo brotherly love.
What you're saying? You're saying there was not love on display?
That there was there's especially following this this massive download. WikiLeaks put up about 20,000 hacked emails from the DNC. These emails were hacked a little bit more than a month ago. They do not put the DNC in a flattering light, and they have led many Bernie Sanders supporters to think about, you know, what they always suspected may actually have been true, which was that the DNC, rather than being a fair arbiter in these primaries, really was kind of putting a finger on the scale for Hillary Clinton and against Bernie Sanders. So that has led to a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters to be, you know, to boo every time on the floor Hillary Clinton or Tim Kaine's name are mentioned. That's going on right now as we speak, in fact. You know, so one might think, oh my gosh, there's all this division and fractiousness in the party. You know, the one thing, I guess, Michael, that I just point out is, you know, having covered, golly, maybe about 10 or 12 of these now, is that, first off, the Democratic conventions are almost always a little bit more raucous. There's simply, you know, more than twice as many delegates, so you're just going to have so many more voices in the hall. And, you know, look at who's speaking tonight, and I guess we can get to that in a minute, but, you know, basically I think what's happening here is this kind of final expression of anger and exasperation and frustration among Sanders supporters. And you know, I think party officials are looking at this thinking, this is fine as long as it sort of wraps up maybe tonight, and then by tomorrow, or certainly Wednesday and Thursday, we move beyond that, and we move to presenting a unified position publicly.
Well, it seems like Sanders himself wants his supporters to move beyond that. In fact, he's speaking this evening and has endorsed Hillary Clinton, as we all know. So why aren't his supporters jumping on board with Hillary as Sanders wants them to?
Well, Bernie Sanders will say, as he did today, he spoke today, and he's been doing some interviews, and as you say, he will be one of four major speakers tonight. First, let's go over the Senator Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Cory Booker, and Michelle Obama. These are all lions among the progressive and sort of left-wing elements of the Democratic Party. It's no accident that they're all speaking tonight. But I also think what's happening is that, you know, that Bernie Sanders and, you know, the kind of the booing, if you look at the people that Bernie Sanders brought into the process, many of them were young, many of them were new to politics, certainly new to the Democratic Party. So they don't feel necessarily, you know, a lot of allegiance to the party or its elements or its structure. And, you know, they look at it like, I got into this, I wanted my candidate to win, he lost, so to heck with all of you. You know, whereas I think more seasoned, you know, delegates and people who participate, you know, they bring all that same energy. They're sad when their candidate loses, but they, you know, they all realize at the end of the day, you know, that's just the way things roll sometimes, and let's get behind our guy or our girl or woman at this point and, you know, really try and make a go of it.
Well, just quickly, what differences have you noticed so far between this Democratic convention and the Republican one that you were at last week?
I think that I think that overall, it's funny that Jonathan Alter was just talking about this. I think the Democrats, believe it or not, actually just know how to put on kind of a more orderly program. I mean, yes, there's booing on the floor and all kinds of people are paying attention to the cat and cameras swirl around. But if you look at what happened at the Republican convention, I mean, you know, delegates, people like Ken Cuccinelli were flinging their credentials to the floor. They were, you know, getting up and storming out of the arena. That's like really serious business. And then even beyond that, all controversies about who said what and who plagiarized who.
Right.
So far, we'll see, but so far this convention just bears all the hallmarks of a Swiss watch. This convention is going to run on time. People are going to stick to message, and they're going to get what they want at the end of it. It seems at this point.
Okay, well, we will find out and we'll hear more from you as the week progresses. Thank you so much to our correspondent, Doug Bernard in Philly. And joining us in the studio here is G. Abby Lee, you know, G, our social media correspondent. Many players at the DNC are talking about this four-day event online. What are they saying?
Hi, Michael. Before the convention kicked off Monday, like Doug mentioned, Bernie Sanders addressed a group of his supporters, and a video clip of his speech has been one of the trending topics on Facebook this afternoon. He urged his supporters to vote for Hillary Clinton and said GOP nominee Donald Trump is a demagogue. And like he also mentioned, he was heavily booed by his supporters. Sanders' team shared a clip on Facebook and captioned it, "Thank you to all of the delegates representing our revolution in Philadelphia, hashtag Dems in Philly." One of the most liked comments reads like this, "We need you, Bernie. You, only you can unite the country. Don't stand down." More than 2,000 people liked that comment in less than 3 hours.
Well, what about Twitter? What are you seeing there?
Sanders addressed the WikiLeaks scandal that was released over the weekend, and this is the most popular tweet he sent out on that issue. "The party leadership must always remain impartial in the presidential nominating process, something which did not occur in the 2016 race. Nearly 22,000 people liked it. But if you think that number is high, check out this tweet by Trump. He tweeted, "Wow, the Republican convention went so smoothly compared to the Dems' total mess. But fear not, the dishonest media will find a good spin."
Okay, so some typical sarcasm there from Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much to G. Abby Lee. If you want to find her on Twitter, she is at G. Abby Lee. I'm at Michael_Lippin, and the show is at VOA_IE. Now let's take a look at some of the headlines on the VOA News website. 19 people are killed in a knife attack in Japan. China sentences former top general to life in prison. Tigers maul two women at a drive-through safari in the Chinese capital, Beijing. Iraq bomb blast kills 11 people. And two people are killed in a shooting at a Florida nightclub here in the U.S. You can find expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com. This is International Edition. The Islamic State militant group's Amaq news agency says a 27-year-old Syrian migrant who set off an explosion killing himself and wounding at least a dozen people in Ansbach, Germany, was one of its soldiers. The top security official in Bavaria, where Ansbach is located, told reporters on Monday that the Syrian attacker had recorded a video on his cell phone pledging allegiance to the leader of IS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Sajan Gohel is the International Security Director of the Asia Pacific Foundation in London. My colleague Sarah Williams spoke to Gohel earlier today and asked him how this blast in Ansbach demonstrates the continuing evolution of Islamic State in Western Europe.
The attack in Ansbach, Germany, may have failed, but it illustrates that ISIS is very keen on recruiting people that are currently living in the UK. And this fits into a message that its head of external operations, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, issued prior to Ramadan, in which he basically told followers that if you cannot join us in Syria, then carry out attacks wherever you are. And that was specifically aimed at people in the West. And we have seen a whole spate of attacks now where people have claimed allegiance to ISIS, even though they may have not been directly trained by them in Raqqa, whether it's in Orlando, Ansbach, Nice. We are seeing more case studies like this.
But it seems like, at least in some cases, the sort of connection is, in some cases, rather tenuous. I mean, some of them could be seen as like a lone wolf that is just inspired by ISIS, but then others literally have had, I guess, some communications with leaders.
The parallel of whether someone has been directly trained by ISIS as opposed to somebody who has tenuous connections by simply just following and heeding the call, in many ways, that is a distinction without a difference. For ISIS, it doesn't matter whether you have been formally connected to the group or whether you just buy into the ideology online. If you carry out an attack in their name, for ISIS, you are very much part of their propaganda, their goals, their agendas, and their strategies. And that is what has been so dangerous about the group, is that it is able to transmit a message which impacts on the psyche of young people across the globe. And it is now very difficult to just stop and disrupt these type of plots from happening, because very often it's just by one individual.
Well, now, this particular person had received psychiatric treatment. He apparently had tried to kill himself twice before, but he was also a Syrian. He was a migrant. And, of course, in the last, you know, within the last year, there have been a number of Syrians who have migrated to Europe, and there have been concerns, security concerns, about some of them.
It is not a coincidence that this individual was an asylum seeker from Syria and claimed allegiance to ISIS. It is very deliberately mischievous and surreptitious by ISIS. They want there to be a backlash against the asylum seekers, the migrants that fled Syria. They want to create social and ethnic tensions in countries like Germany, which has taken over 1 million people from Syria. This is a very deliberate and calculated strategy for them to foment tension. It's important not to fall into that trap.
And that was Sajan Gohel, International Security Director of the Asia Pacific Foundation in London, speaking to Sarah Williams. The International Olympic Committee, or IOC, has decided not to issue a total ban on Russian athletes competing in the Rio Olympic Games starting in 12 days. The IOC made the decision on Sunday, despite last week's World Anti-Doping Association report that found evidence of state-sponsored doping by Russian athletes at the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia. Several Western anti-doping officials expressed disappointment on Monday that the IOC did not impose a complete ban on Russia at Rio. I spoke earlier on the phone to international sports attorney David Larkin here in Washington, and I asked him what he thinks of that criticism.
I take quite seriously the allegation that there's wrongdoing in Russian sports and perhaps among athletes. That is a very serious allegation, and I do not dismiss it. On the other hand, we've also got to contemplate that there are innocent Russian athletes who've been caught up in this hurricane of wrongdoing, and we've also got to think about them, especially when all of the things that we're doing right now could be precedent and will be precedent for how these types of events occur in the future. So all of that is why we've got to be really careful about having a good process, because it's not just going to affect Russian athletes now. This has repercussions for how other athletes of every nation are treated in the future, so we've just got to pay attention to it.
And what are those repercussions? How will this affect the way other athletes from other countries are treated?
Well, the best way to think about it is to put the shoe on the other foot. Let's say that there was a allegations of impropriety in U.S. sports. And in Russia, an investigation was launched, and a report was compiled that said that there was a state-sponsored doping scheme in the United States. Only all of the allegations contained in that report were none of that information was proffered to and no questions were asked of anyone in the United States. And then on that basis, there was a movement in the IOC to ban, blanket ban, U.S. athletes on the basis of that report and allegations of wrongdoing. That's kind of where we are with regards to this Russian process. The reason that sports lawyers are all raising red flags in this process is because the process itself has a lot of issues that are really concerning as to how we handle allegations of wrongdoing in the future. If we're going to have these going to use incomplete investigations that are never allowed to be answered by the people who are alleged to have committed the wrongdoing, then this sets us up for a really, really nasty process that could just have a base. We could have baseless bands of people left, right, and center in the future from in the United States, in Canada, everywhere else. And so that's why the process matters so much here.
But isn't there such an overwhelming weight of evidence of Russian state-sponsored doping that having Russians take part in Rio would just undermine the credibility of that event in the eyes of global sports fans?
You know, I understand the concern, but we've got to fall back on 1,000 years of legal precedent and learning, and it tells us this: that blanket justice isn't justice. If we're going to paint everybody with a broad brush, we're victimizing people who truly are innocent. And that's not right. We've learned over 1,000 years of the common law legal history that it's wrong to do that because you're victimizing the innocent, and that's why you can't do that. It's not that simple.
Okay, well, thank you very much to international sports lawyer David Larkin, who's based here in D.C., for speaking to International Edition.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists working with what has been purported to be the world's most sensitive dark matter detector say that despite spending 20 months looking for the mysterious stuff, they have not been able to detect even a single trace of it. The large underground xenon dark matter experiment was conducted at the Sanford Underground Research Facilities, located beneath about 1.6 kilometers of earth and rock in the Black Hills of South Dakota. The Lux scientists say their detector was so sensitive that if any dark matter particles had actually interacted with their device, it would have certainly pointed them out. The researchers say their experiment gathered and then later analyzed nearly 500 terabytes worth of data. Findings from the Lux experiment will be used to help those conducted in the future, such as the Lux Zeppelin experiment, which is expected to continue the search for dark matter in 2020. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. California State's Silicon Valley is not just home to major tech companies like Google, Facebook, and Apple. The region also is known for its startup culture. VOA's Elizabeth Lee went inside one company to find out what it's like to work in the startup.
Running a company with a treadmill inside in the middle of Silicon Valley is not what Monisha Prakash had imagined when she and her parents immigrated to the U.S. from Nepal.
I tell you, when I first moved out here, I got a call from my father, who was living in Texas, and he said, you know, Monisha, I've looked all over the map, and I can't find the Silicon Valley anywhere.
Prakash says Silicon Valley is not just a region in California, but a culture that embodies entrepreneurship. The culture is infectious, she says, and it touched her when she came to Silicon Valley.
At first, my parents were very confused. I had started out pre-med, and I got into medical school. And when I chose not to go, they didn't understand why.
Prakash says she and her two co-founders wanted to form a startup using technology to improve the lives of people. Their answer was Lumo Body Tech, a company that developed wearable sensors to improve posture and help runners avoid injury.
There are a lot of studies that show posture being highly correlated with back pain, back health.
Charles Wong, whose parents are from Taiwan, started as a doctor but became an entrepreneur. He says this sensor, called the Lumo Lift, vibrates when the wearer slouches as a reminder to sit up, reducing the risk of back pain. Another sensor can be worn while a person is running and tracks the runner's movement. Paired with a mobile phone, it can provide personalized coaching to the runner.
To decrease the time your foot is on the ground. Pump your arms and finish each arm swing with your...
Being a part of a startup is similar to running, says another co-founder, Andrew Chang.
Magnitude. Like, you can't even compare the speed that you move at, the speed in which you make decisions, in which things happen, and so on and so forth, because there is a lot less bureaucracy.
Wong says being a part of a startup means one has to learn quickly and meet new challenges every day.
Super fun. I mean, I think I've learned so many different things in the role that I've had here.
Prakash says it's fun because there is a spirit of collaboration throughout Silicon Valley, and it's fueling the startup culture here. She says seeing the success of her startup has been a source of joy for her parents.
I want to make them proud, and I want them to know that by giving us this opportunity to pursue anything we want, pursue our dreams, that I'm carrying that on. And so in a lot of ways, it's an honoring them that I do what I do.
For anyone who wants to follow in her footsteps, Prakash says, do not fear failure. Embrace it as an opportunity to learn.
Increase your steps per minute to
Elizabeth
improve
Lee, VOA News, Mountain View, California.
That's it for International Edition. We'll have more on the Democratic National Convention in our next program at 0330 Universal Time. I'd like to thank our director for today's show, Tracy Carter, and the engineer, Jim Harmon. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Michael_Lippin. And you can follow our show, too. We are at VOA_IE. Have a great week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Once the fighting ends, peace treaties are signed, and armies are disbanded, the world assumes too often that life in former conflict areas will soon return to normal. But leftover landmines and unexploded munitions stand in the way of post-conflict stabilization and inhibit long-term development. They render thousands of hectares of land unusable and destabilize communities. To mitigate long-term damage and help war-ravaged communities move toward a sustainable peace, the United States has, since 1993, provided over $2.6 billion for conventional weapons destruction programs that help to safely clear landmines and explosive remnants of war, such as ammunition, artillery shells, and air-delivered bombs. Still, in many countries, landmines and unexploded ordnance can kill and maim their victims decades after the original conflict is little more than an ugly memory. Completely ridding former battlegrounds of these explosives is, therefore, a long-term project. This effort cannot succeed without building local expertise in partner nations and training leaders that can take control of mine clearance programs in their own countries. The Center for International Stabilization and Recovery at James Madison University in the state of Virginia has for many years conducted management training for leaders in humanitarian mine action around the world. Since 2010, the State Department's Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement has sponsored the course, which seeks to integrate the latest ideas in business management with the practical experience of mine clearance professionals. The goal is to train senior managers of national demining programs to make the programs function more effectively and efficiently. In late spring of this year, the university hosted 21 demining management professionals from Afghanistan, Colombia, Iraq, Laos, Lebanon, Libya, Palau, Senegal, Sri Lanka, Somalia, Tajikistan, Vietnam, and Yemen. They honed their technical and managerial skill, which they will now apply improving their country's capacity to clear contaminated land. The United States is investing in mine and explosives clearance because by doing so, we not only protect civilians from explosive remnants of war, but we also enable lasting peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.